On the 19th day after their departure from Saltillo, two of the soldiers bringing up the rear galloped forward. "Party overtaking us from the rear," one reported. Everyone turned around and saw that the soldiers were right. A column of some kind was approaching at a worrisome speed, and a hasty consultation took place. The commander asked, "Am I right? No unit is supposed to be on this road?"
"None that we know of, sir."
"Comanche?"
"I think so."
Men instinctively fingered their guns. "Women to the front, immediate." The captain hesitated.
"I mean, to the rear as we face them."
The approaching column, which appeared to be some 15 or 16 Indians, must have seen the soldiers halt and take up defensive positions. But on they came, and as the dust rose, Don Ramon, his white hair unprotected by any hat, rode back to take position in front of the women. "You are not to cry panic. You are not to run. I will hold them off." He saluted his two women, but the effect of his words was lost when Trinidad cried joyously, "It's René Claude!" And deftly she spurred her horse and dashed out to meet the Frenchman, whose party had left Saltillo almost 2 weeks later than the Saldanhas, but had been able, by means of long rides each day, to overtake them. It was a lively meeting there in the great empty upland of Mexico, with blue mountains in the distance and spring flowers covering the swales. Soldiers from both groups swapped stories, and the two other merchants who had been invited by young Dombrus to join his entourage talked with Don Ramon about conditions in both Coahuila and Tejas. But the two who reveled most in the fortunate meeting were Trinidad and René Claude, for without the distracting presence of Doroteo Galindez, the young Frenchman was free to discover what a delightful young woman Trinidad was. They rode their horses ahead of the line, or off to one side, chattering easily and endlessly. One morning, Trinidad thought, "Today I wish he would try to kiss me." And when they were off toward the mountains, he did just that. She encouraged him at first, then pushed him away and said, "I saw you kissing Dorotea." And he explained, "Sometimes that happens, but this is forever." "Did you enjoy kissing her?" she asked. And he said, "Of course. But it was your funny little smile I saw at night when I was alone." "You may kiss me," she said, leaning across her horse's neck. When they were in the presence of the elders, they had to be more circumspect. Then they sat and talked. And one evening Trinidad asked him to explain his name. "Many French boys have two names, like mine, and the little D is your day. Means the same, the place where your family came from, an honorable designation." He tried to teach her how to pronounce his last name with a French twirl, and when her tongue could not master it, he accused her of being dull-witted. "How about you?" And she mimicked him by saying Trinidad the way he did, with a heavy accent on the last syllable, as if it really were Dodd, rhyming with Nod. "It's not that way at all," she protested. "It's Thav, soft, a whispering song." Now it was he whose tongue became twisted. But at last, with her gentle coaching, he mastered this beautiful name, Trinidad. "It really is a song." And so they continued, two young people in love, finding music in each other's names, respect for each other's traditions. In fact, the pair became so open in their affection that Don Ramon told Ingracia, "Well or sick, you must go out and act as dueña for your child." Then, in some confusion, but with his jaw set, he ordered Trinidad to get into the wagon and sit with Engracia, while he rode ahead to talk with the young Frenchman. "There is always the matter of honor, young man. Surely you will agree to that." Dombrus, bewildered that Trinidad had left him, and that Don Ramon had taken her place, mumbled something about men always being beholden to the demands of honor, duels and things like that. He spoke as if he certainly did not expect to be challenged to a duel.
I mean, Don Ramon said, turning sideways on his horse, those ancient rules which have always governed the behavior of gentlemen.
Oh, that, yes. Women first into the carriage, men to hold the horses lest they bolt.
Oh, yes.
He spoke with such enthusiasm that one might have thought he was Europe's champion of the ancient rules, that he would lay down his life in furtherance of them.
I mean the subtler kind, young man.
Well, René Claude's voice trailed off, for now he was truly bewildered. It has always been a rule among gentlemen, rigorously observed by all who presume to call themselves that.
Now Don Ramon hesitated.
Are you a gentleman?
Before René Claude could respond, he added, I mean, your father is in trade, isn't he?
He spat out the words distastefully. The young man drew to attention. The D'Ambreuse family own large vineyards near Bern, and do you know where Bern is?
Burgundy, its own principality.
No one owns large vineyards there unless they are gentlemen. Nobility, really.
But in New Orleans, your father is in trade?
My father's an inventor. He devises machines used in mines.
I'm a gentleman, so educated and trained as were my great-grandfather before me and his great-grandfather before him. But more important, I'm a Burgundian.
Well, yes, Don Ramon said, shifting his weight to bring his face closer to D'Ambreuse.
What I mean, there's a rule among gentlemen that no one can come into another man's castle and seduce his daughter, not while the visitor is a guest in the castle.
D'Ambreuse said nothing, for now he knew the burden of the old man's warning.
By joining the Saldanha party without an invitation, he had assumed the role of guest, whether he intended so or not, and he was bound by the most ancient code not to take advantage of the daughter of the house, not while he was in this privileged position. In the fluid life of San Luis Potosí, or on the wide avenues of the capital, he might feel free to seduce her, if his charms and stratagems prevailed, but not while he was a guest in the home, as it were, of Don Ramon.
It would never have occurred to me to take advantage, he said.
It occurred to me, Don Ramon replied.
Now, shall we stop for our morning rest? It was this unnecessary halt which made up the minds of the two guest merchants.
We do not like to say this, but this dallying, these picnics, we're wasting valuable time. Our soldiers, too, they want to move ahead.
We shall. I've been inconsiderate of you gentlemen, and I'm sorry. And René Claude announced to the group resting by the side of the road, a rather good highway now, since it had been in use 2 centuries longer than the miserable roads in Tejas, that he and his company must reluctantly forge ahead. He went to Trinidad, and taking her by the hands, he drew her to him and embraced her in front of the others, then bowed low, as if wearing a plumed hat in the old days.
Mademoiselle, we shall meet again in Potosí, or Mexico, or New Orleans. But wherever it is, it will be heaven.
Saluting Don Ramon and the soldiers who would be staying with the slower party, he went to the head of his column and led his entourage across the beautiful spaces of upland Mexico. Days later, as the Saldanhas approached Potosí, Trinidad rode with her grandfather and confided,
I shall pray tonight that René Claude's negotiations have kept him here longer than he intended.
I doubt, dearest child, that you could ever marry a Frenchman. They're not dependable. I've never believed that they're serious Catholics.
He poured forth a century of Spanish apprehensions about their northern neighbors, ending with a prophetic warning.
I even doubt that New Orleans will remain Spanish till the end of the century.
What possibly could happen? Trinidad asked. René Claude himself told me they have no armies in America. With the French, something always happens. Do not count on young Dombreuse.
Don't you like him?
Too much, her grandfather confessed. And I see that you like him too much, also.
Be careful, Trinidad. He comes with the wind. He goes with the sunrise.
But his granddaughter's ardent hopes were realized. By one device and another, René Claude had managed to linger on in the mining town, attending to business which he did not have, and wasting so much time that his two companions had proceeded to Mexico City without him. Each day he had watched El Camino Real for signs of travelers coming down from the north. And on a bright July day, two men, traveling without military guard, rode into town with the exciting news that Don Ramon Saldana, from the distant town of Béjar in Texas, would be arriving, if his current slow speed held, on the morrow. Upon receipt of this news, René Claude saddled his horse, hired three companions, and rode north to escort the travelers properly. Trinidad had supposed that this might happen, for she had paid the two men to seek out the young Frenchman and inform him of her coming. She was therefore at the head of her column when she spied the four horsemen, and without waiting for confirmation, she dashed ahead, waved vigorously when she saw René Claude, and brought her horse close to his so that she could kiss him. When the two groups met formally, Don Ramon said brusquely, "I had hoped you were in Mexico City." "I should be, but I had to see you and your daughter again." "Let us not deter you. You've made your welcome. You will show us to our inn, I feel sure, and then you will hurry on."
"That I shall, Don Ramon. But first I must speak seriously with you."
"That can wait till we've cleaned up," he said. And he would speak no more until he had seen his women properly ensconced in their quarters at the inn. It was a place of thick walls and many rooms, in one of which the two men met over drinks of cool pomegranate juice. "Don Ramon, I seek your permission to pay serious court to your granddaughter. She's not 15. She will be when you've returned to Béjar, and I stop by to claim her."
"What are your prospects?"
"The best, Don Ramon, as you will find when you inquire about me in the capital. I am a younger son, it's true, and my older brothers have the vineyards. But I've done well in New Orleans, and in Saltillo, and Potosí, and I'm sure I'll do even better in the capital. For that you need have no concern."
"In Saltillo, you seemed quite enamored of the innkeeper's daughter."
"In spring, the birds inspect many trees before they build their nests."
They do, Don Ramon said, recalling his own casual courtships. But then he spoke forcefully. "I'm a Spaniard, and I'm taking my granddaughter to the capital so that she can meet Spaniards. French and Spanish, it's never been any good. You've had Frenchmen as your kings, and that's been worst of all."
There in Potosí, the battle lines were drawn. It was obvious that the young Frenchman would continue to pay ardent suit to Trinidad, while the old Spaniard would do all he could to keep the young lover separated, or at least under close surveillance. Don Ramon, accepting the challenge, said, "I doubt that a granddaughter of mine would ever want to marry a Frenchman."
"With all respect, Don Ramon, I disagree."
"I doubt that I could ever give my consent." But he liked the young man's spirit and did not try to prevent him from taking rooms at the same inn. Now began a clever game of cat and mouse, with the Frenchman testing every gambit to place himself alone with Trinidad, and her grandfather using his talents to outwit him. Alas, Don Ramon's own grandchild sided with the enemy, exchanging surreptitious messages of love and stolen kisses. But with Engracia's determined help, Saldana did succeed in protecting his child's honor.
After 4 days of this, he suggested bluntly that Dumbruz move on.
After 4 days of this, he suggested bluntly that Dumbruz move on. Your business waits. And to his surprise, the brash young fellow said, It does indeed. But I also shall wait. In the capital. And he was off, this time without escort. For south of Potosí, El Camino Real became a major road in the silver trade, and soldiers guarded it on a permanent basis. 2 weeks later, the Saldañas started their own 120-league trip south, which they took at a pace more leisurely than before, so that it was early August before they entered upon that splendid final plateau on which stood the marvel of the New World. If Trinidad had been impressed by Saltillo as a major center, she was dumbfounded by the capital, for it exceeded even the stories that soldiers had recited during the long journey. The cathedral was 3 times the size of the lovely church in Saltillo, the plaza 15 or 20 times larger. And if the shops in the northern town had been lavish, the ones in Mexico City were true cornucopias, crowded with elegant wares from all over Europe, brocades and silks and intricately woven cottons and hammered gold for women, guns and silver-handled swords and burnished leatherware from Toledo and fine suitings for the men. What made the capital even more exciting was that on the second morning René Claude appeared at the Saldañas Inn, prepared to escort Trinidad and her mother to various parts of the metropolis, the bullring where masters from Spain performed, the concert halls where fine singers from all over Europe entertained, and those unique taverns which started serving delectable dinners at 11 o'clock at night. Here Trinidad could listen to the wandering Negro poets recite impudent impromptu verses cataloguing the scandals of the day. Standing before her table one night, the best of the black poets cried with obvious joy, Little girl with a laughing smile, please stay among us for a while. Mexico is criminal, it's true. That's why we need a pretty little. That's why we need a witty little. That's why we need a lovely little girl like you. The poetry wasn't very good, but it was delivered with great enthusiasm and considerable boldness. To Don Ramon, the poet declaimed, While you spend money wildly in the city, the clerks back home are checking on your books. They scratch their heads and say, The pity! These figures prove that you're the chief of crooks. At this sally, the crowded tavern applauded, and other diners pointed their fingers at Don Ramon and chided him for being a thief. He was required to nod and smile and tip the insulting poet handsomely, for if he failed to do any of these things, the black man would remain there, shouting really damaging verses. However, on this occasion, the minstrel achieved his greatest success with the lines he launched at René Claude. My fine young lad with eyes of blue, I see you come from France, but our police are on to you, so do not take a chance. For if you try to steal our girl, this entire town will rise and knock your head into a whirl and boot you to the skies. Take my advice, young man of France, forget the old man's threats. Lead forth your lady to the dance, and you will cash your bets. With this, he threw his arms wide, reached down and kissed Trinidad, embraced René Claude, and after gathering coins from the latter, danced his way through the restaurant, a figure of whirling grace, black as the night, and free to exercise privileges no one else in that room would have dared. At the exit, he leaped, turned in midair, and threw the entire assembly kisses with his long, agile fingers. There was nothing in Tejas like this black poet, nor was there anything like the grandeur of Mexico City, or its university more than 2 centuries old. And as Trinidad came to know the metropolis, in which she would remain for 30 years, she also came to understand something of Spain's glory.
She knew now why her grandfather was so proud of his heritage and wanted her to share it with a Spanish husband who might even take her back to the homeland. One night, after they had attended one of the city's dozen theaters for a program of one-act plays and singing, she confided, "It seems so old and so learned, and the building so important. It's not at all like our poor Tejas." And Don Ramon said, "Spain itself is even better." But his search for a Spanish son-in-law was not going well, and he was relieved when D'Ambreuse announced that he must go down to Veracruz to supervise the arrival of mining equipment from France, but was appalled when the young man suggested that the Saldañas accompany him, for it would be a distance of some 70 leagues through fever-ridden jungle. However, Trinidad made such an outcry about wishing to visit Puebla, one of the most gracious cities in the entire Spanish Empire, that he did agree to lead his family that far. There, in what was called the City of the Angels, with the great volcanoes looming over the myriad churches, 365 in outlying Cholula alone, they said farewell to D'Ambreuse. Don Ramon saluted him, Engracia allowed him to kiss her, and Trinidad clung to him as the horses were brought up for the dangerous journey down to where the ships from Europe arrived almost every week. Back in the capital, Don Ramon made serious inquiry concerning D'Ambreuse, and learned from officials who had served in both Spain and New Orleans that he did indeed come from an excellent family, and that his people in Louisiana had been among the first to accept Spanish rule back in the 1760s. One diplomat said, "We had to hang a dozen French leaders, you know. They were stubborn, would accept nothing Spanish, so we strung them up. But the D'Ambreuse clan were different. Good Frenchmen, good Catholics, and now they're good Spaniards. There's been talk that René Claude's father, or perhaps René Claude himself, in due course, might be our Spanish governor in New Orleans. So the young man is not a nobody, of that you can be sure, Don Ramon." Over the weeks, Saldaña pondered his problem. And one afternoon, when Trinidad was out with her friends, visiting the architectural masterpieces of the capital, he said to her mother, "By 16, our precious little lady ought to be married. I'm afraid my dream of Spain was fruitless. I have the sad feeling that our good friend Veramendi was correct when he predicted that the real power would be coming down El Camino Real from the north and not up from the south." "Are you saying?" "I'm saying that when I study the decline of Spain in the New World, our young French friend begins to look better every day." Oh, dear. Engracia was not prepared for a French son-in-law, nor for the French to have a foothold of any kind in Mexico, especially Tejas. In the old days, things were so much simpler. When D'Ambreuse returned from Veracruz, bronzed and temporarily underweight because of fever, so that he seemed almost a wraith, he insisted that everyone accompany him on an expedition to the ruins of some pyramids north of the city. A field trip involving many horses and servants was arranged, and when the Saldañas stood at the base of the major pyramid, its sides encrusted with growing trees and small shrubs, they marveled at the building talents of the ancients. For the first time, Don Ramon contemplated the fact that before the Spanish came to Mexico, Indians of great ability must have lived here, capable of building edifices 10 times more grand than anything yet seen in Tejas. It was a disturbing thought to a man who had always scorned Indians. But the impact of the pyramids was even greater on Trinidad, for she could not believe that these wonders looming out of the wasteland could have been built by the ancestors of the Indians she had known. And a most strange thought occurred to her, which she shared with her parents. "They must have been different Indians from the ones we see. That Indian maiden who married the Spanish soldier Garza, she must have been quite different." And when she returned to the city,
she began looking into the faces of the Indians, staring at them impolitely, trying to find in them any indication of the master builders who had constructed those pyramids. When the Saldanhas returned to the capital from this excursion, Don Ramon slumped in a chair and told Ingracia, "I don't think we're going to find a proper husband for Trinidad." "Not here," she agreed. "It looks as if Spain has already surrendered Mexico. She's surely not sending any young officers here." Therefore, Don Ramon did not immediately reject René Claude's impertinent suggestion that he accompany the Saldanha expedition back to Béjar. But something the young man said alerted the old man to the fact that the young people were rather more deeply in love than he had anticipated. "I had planned to sail back to France, report to my uncles, and return to my job in New Orleans." "Why did you change your plans?" "I wrote my uncles that I had found in Mexico the girl I wanted to marry, and that I would seek to go home your way." "You may join us," Don Ramon conceded, without enthusiasm. But the young man realized that to win Trinidad he must please her grandfather, so he said brightly, "In Veracruz, a man at the port told me to ask when I next saw you," and here he took out a worn slip of paper, "Are you really an Hidalgo de Bragueta?" Don Ramon straightened as if he were about to salute the king. "I am indeed." Then he chuckled, "Self-appointed, you might say." "And what is it? The banker wouldn't tell me." "It means that the king himself would have granted me the right to use the title Don if I lived in Spain." "For what?" "For siring 7 sons in a row, no daughters." But as soon as he said this, he added, "I did have 7 sons, and all died, but not one of them gave me the extreme joy my granddaughter does." D'Ambreuse rose, stood at attention, and said, "Don Ramon, I salute you, and I hope that I shall be allowed to give you 7 great-grandchildren." But Ramon de Saldanha was no fool, and he knew well that young men often woo young girls with faithless promises, then leave them in despair, and both he and Engracia began telling Trinidad, when they had her alone, of that endless chain of tragedies in which unsuspecting girls were betrayed. "There was the Escobar girl in Zacatecas when I was young. This high official of the court in Madrid came out to try a case of thievery from the silver mines." It mattered not who was doing the preaching. The histories were all the same. "Shortly after my father took command at the Presidio in Béjar, I was just a boy, but I remember this girl Eufemia, sent up from Potosí to stay with her brother, who was our lieutenant, while she had her baby. It was a baby boy, and after Uncle Damian christened him, with her brother attending, well, the lieutenant asked for leave. My father granted it, and 3 months later the young man returned to Béjar with a simple announcement, 'I killed him.' And we were all happy that his honor and that of his sister had been restored." In conjunction with his moralizing stories, Don Ramon kept a severe watch upon his granddaughter, and this was effective in San Luis Potosí and during the long march north of there. But now, as the young people approached Saltillo, a magical city even if one were not in love, it was obvious that the lovers had reached a point of commitment. They were determined to marry, and they wanted that mutual promise publicly announced, so Don Ramon watched with extra diligence. As they entered the city, and Trinidad saw once more the plaza where she had met René Claude, a frightening thought overtook her. For she remembered that it had been Dorotea Galindez whom he had kissed in Saltillo, and she wondered what might happen when the two met again. But when they reached the inn, she heard Dorotea's hearty cry, "My dearest friend Trinidad, meet my husband." So that danger dissolved. It had been a long day's ride, this final stage to Saltillo, and at midnight Don Ramon was truly fatigued. He slept so soundly that he did not hear Trinidad slip down the tiled hall and out through a window where D'Ambreuse was waiting. They walked back to the plaza where they had met and saw two beggars, their clothes in tatters, sleeping in a doorway. They saw the verger swing shut the gates of the church and wend his way home. They heard the night watchman, who would query them if he found them in the streets, and then they discovered an alleyway leading to a sheltered garden. And when they were under the trees, René Claude put cupped hands to his mouth as if he were going to shout. Instead, he whispered, "Don Ramon, heaven is my witness that we are not in your castle." Then he told Trinidad, "I am free to make you my wife." And there they sealed their love. One day south of Béjar, when Don Ramon had about decided that he must soon discuss with René Claude the size of Trinidad's dowry, most of the soldiers galloped ahead to inform the town of the Saldaña's return. And while the reduced caravan was in the process of fording the Medina prior to re-entering Tejas, the Apache struck. There were more than 24 warriors, and Trinidad would have been carried off had not Don Ramon defended her valiantly. But the Apache, having seen how young she was, stopped fighting the soldiers and tried again to capture her, for she would be a prize among the campfires. But now René Claude, only 20 years old, galloped directly at them, drove them back, and took 3 arrows through his chest. His horse ran blindly on, taking him closer to the Indians, who sought to take him alive for the protracted tortures they enjoyed. But with his dying strength, he struck at them until they had to cut his throat to subdue him. When the Saldañas brought Trinidad to their house in the church plaza, she passed into a kind of coma, unwilling to believe that her chivalric, loving young man had somehow vanished from the earth, as dead as those shadowy figures who had built the pyramids. And she remained in this condition for several days. Fray Ildefonso from Santa Teresa came to talk with her, but she stared right past him and would say nothing. Finally, on the 5th day, he shook her and said sternly, "Each morning the rooster crows, and you've lost 5 of his days. Now get up and get dressed." And he stayed right there in the low-ceilinged room until she left her bed. When her mother's nourishing meals had restored her strength, she ventured into the plaza. But seeing the church at one end and a bed of flowers beside the governor's residence at the other, she imagined that she was back in Saltillo, and sorrow overcame her, and she fled back to her room, where she would have returned to her bed, had not Fray Ildefonso given strict orders that this must not be permitted. So she walked like a forlorn ghost through the beautiful rooms of her home, and gradually regained control of herself. René Claude was dead, and a large part of her heart was dead, too. But Fray Ildefonso's sagacious counsel helped her to see her inescapable situation. "You're 15 years old. 4 times that many years lie ahead, and you must use them wisely. God intended you to be the guiding spirit of a Christian household, the mother of children who will help build his world. That is your proud destiny, and you must work toward it. So, cook for the poor, help at the mission." It was repugnant to contemplate the full resumption of life after so grievous a loss, and the idea that she should in the future encounter someone whom she might want to marry was inconceivable. But her common sense affirmed Ildefonso's basic counsel, that she must reintroduce herself into the mainstream of life. Few girls of 15 in northern Mexico had ever seen so clearly the grand design of life. So she squared her shoulders and prepared to take her place within it. What appealed to her most, after her profound experience at the pyramids, was to work at Mission Santa Teresa, for there she could help the Indian mothers care for their babies. But the new priest in town, this Father Ibarra, who had come north to see if the missions should be closed down, absolutely forbade her to step foot inside Santa Teresa. "This place is not for women. If God had intended you to enter these precincts, he would have made women friars." When Fray Ildefonso explained that this poor child of God needed such work in order to protect her sanity, Father Ibarra, a member of the secular clergy who had never liked Franciscans to begin with, told the gentle friar to mind his own business. And within a week, Fray Ildefonso was on his way back to the college in Zacatecas. In his absence, Father Ibarra was even harsher with Trinidad. "Stay where you belong. Pray. Strive to regain God's grace." Such orders Trinidad refused to obey, and with obvious distaste, Father Ibarra watched her moving about the village as if she were a married woman. And for no specific reason, he conceived a great dislike for this girl with the twisted mouth, who always seemed to be smirking sardonically at what he said. In church, on Wednesdays and Sundays, he tried not to look at her, for he was obsessed with the idea that she was somehow allied with the devil. When one of the Saldana servants informed him that in Saltillo on the way north, some funny business happened on several nights when the young one slipped past the sleeping Don Ramon, he began to watch her closely, hoping that she was pregnant. He practiced the anathema he would hurl at her from his pulpit when her shame was known. Hussy, slut, harlot, and wanton featured heavily. And he was disappointed when it became obvious that she was not with child. As he went about his duties, those assigned him by the viceroy, who had long suspected that expenses of the northern missions were unjustified when compared with the meager results they produced, he also developed an intense hatred for Mission Santa Teresa, whose saintly founder, Fray Damian, he saw as a charlatan. Got himself killed by the Apache in their camp, fooling around with their women, no doubt. He convinced himself, because of his extreme dislike for Trinidad, that he must somehow unmask the chicanery of her great-uncle Damian, and he spent much of his energy trying to do just that. He also convinced himself that Trinidad herself, a loose girl with an irreverent attitude, would come to no good, and several times he considered excommunicating her until she showed proper humility. But he was afraid to do so because of the importance of the Saldanas and their obvious friendship with the Veramendis. He was in the plaza one morning, watching attentively as Trinidad left her house to meddle in some improper affair or other, when he saw her run across the square and throw her arms about Amalia Veramendi, Don Lazaro's daughter, as if they were old friends. The girls talked animatedly for some minutes, then walked off arm in arm. He wondered what secrets they had. It was easily explained. Since the day of the Apache attack, Trinidad had been unable to mention René Claude's name, but desperately she had wanted to. And perhaps it was this cruel blockage that had driven her into a depression. Now, with a sympathetic young woman about her own age, available and interested, she was at last free to talk. "You can't imagine, Amalia, how wonderful he was." This was an unfortunate beginning, because Amalia looked sideways at her friend and thought, "You'd be amazed at what I can imagine." Trinidad, unaware of the envy she was creating, burbled on. Grandfather did everything possible to humiliate him, drive him away, said no child of his would ever marry a damned Frenchman. René Claude just smiled, gave grandfather all the courtesies, and melted him the way the sun melts snow in the Alps. Amalia, suspecting that her friend had enjoyed experiences denied her, wanted to explore more deeply, but refrained. With feigned girlish modesty, she asked. Was it? Well, is loving a man, do you have to surrender as much as it seems?
Not with René Claude. He said we would be equals, and he behaved that way. Of course, he'd take care of the money and make all the big decisions, and maybe we'd live in Saltillo or maybe New Orleans. He'd decide that. But he asked me always what I wanted, which horse I preferred. The girls, each so eager to confide, still shied away from honest questions and answers.
Is loving a man, Amalia began, well, is it, does it?
This should have encouraged Trinidad to speak her feelings. Instead, she reflected, smiled at Amalia, and said,
It's all right.
This new priest, Father Ibarra, he condemns it. He seems very afraid of love. Father Ibarra is a fool. It was unfortunate that Trinidad said this, even to her trusted friend, because although Amalia was of the same opinion, when she criticized Ibarra to others, she repeated not her own judgment, but Trinidad's. And when word of this reached the priest's ears, his mind became set. He would settle with the Saldanas, important though they might be.